Meeting is now streaming live on Facebook, and I'm here with Fernando Cortez. You may have seen some YouTube videos with this handsome stud here, where he's explaining some hitting drills and some fielding drills, a great asset to the Hugo Pro Baseball YouTube channel. But he also has a facility in Southern California, Fernando Cortez Baseball on Instagram. He is the man, former MLB middle infielder, my good friend, Fernando Cortez. What's up, man? How you doing?
What's up, man? Appreciate you having me on. You know, I'm just quarantined like everybody else. I'm locked up. They won't let me out.
I hear you, man. Hopefully we'll get back to normal soon. But I wanted to take this opportunity while I have you on here to kind of go a little bit deeper than we normally do on our YouTube videos and kind of just get to let the audience know you a little bit better and talk more in depth about kind of some things that I have in mind. So if you would please tell the people who is Fernando Cortez and share your journey through from when you started playing baseball until you finished playing baseball, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So originally I was just, you know, a kid running outside playing sports. And that's really been, you know, my life really is sports. I played football, played basketball, ran track. Obviously you played baseball. And, you know, all these different sports growing up, I was always outside. You know, my dream was to actually be a baseball player when it was all said and done and I had to pick between the sports. I used to go to bed. I remember just kind of laying down before I go to bed, say my prayer. And then I would just like replay all these highlights of the Braves and the Padres in my head. And I just kind of would always visualize myself being in that situation, in that moment as a baseball player. So throughout my whole life, I ended up, you know, playing all these sports, little league, high school. I ended up playing football, baseball, basketball, and then went into JUCO, got drafted out of there, played baseball. And then I just kept going all the way up until, you know, I reached the major leagues. But sports has pretty much been my whole life. Taught me great things in life, taught me how to fail, taught me how to succeed, taught me about adversity. So, you know, that old saying where, you know, life is like sports, for me, that has been my experience.
Tell the story about when you were going to sell a baseball card to play one season. Tell that story. I love that story.
Okay. So that was ninth grade, freshman year. We just came out of Pony going into Colt out here in California. I don't know if you guys have Colt, but we go from Little League to Pony to Colt. And Colt was, the registration fee was about, it was $99. So it was $100. And, you know, I grew up with a single mom. So my mom provided for myself and my sister. My sister was a cheerleader. So at a rival high school. So, you know, funds, you know, just weren't there for us typically. And, you know, having to choose between who she's going to pay for, what cleats, you know, what cheerleading outfit, what tournament, so on and so forth. I was in a position to where I wasn't going to be able to get to play baseball with all my friends in a very competitive league. So I had a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card in a case. And at the time, the two top baseball cards that were on the market in Beckett were the 90 Leaf Frank Thomas and the 89 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. And I had the Griffey Jr. He was my favorite player at the time. And I was literally like moments away from selling it for $100 so that I could take the $100 and then I can go play in the Colt League. Word got out that I was selling the Griffey, and a friend of mine told his dad, and his dad said, no, he's not selling that Griffey card. I'll pay for his registration and he's going to be on my team. So he ended up paying for the registration. I ended up going on his team. I still got the Griffey rookie to this day. It's actually sitting on my workbench in the garage in the same slab, everything. And I think the way I acquired it, I probably traded 200, 300 different assorted cards, Ripkins, you know, McGriff, Frank Thomas, a bunch of cards just to get that one card. But what's cool to me now that I'm older and I'm able to realize what actually transpired and what happened, you know, at the time I'm 15. Now I'm thinking back like, wow, somebody said, no, you're not selling that Griffey Jr. I'm going to pay for you. I know your mother's struggling and you're going to play baseball. So that was probably one of the first times that I can recall and remember that somebody went above and beyond to help me out so that I can continue to play baseball. And that's something that sticks with me now because, you know, I work with kids and you work with kids. And now we have the opportunity and the ability to give back, you know, whatever way we can. So that's something that's always stuck with me.
And you do that. You do that very well, I might add. You give so much information out there on your social media platforms. Obviously, you know, you did some stuff with me on YouTube. You're just very gracious with everything you do. So for that, we want to say thank you. I want to say personally thank you. And I'm sure the rest of the world will say thank you.
Well, I appreciate what you do, too. That's why we're here together doing it, you know?
Absolutely. Now, tell me, what were some struggles that you had coming up? Obviously, that was a struggle, but I'm sure there were many more bumps in the road. Is there anything that you could look back at and stands out to you that you really had to overcome on your path to playing at the higher levels?
I think it all kind of started when I was younger, being just one of the smaller guys, you know. I had to kind of figure out how I could separate myself from the next player. Everybody, you know, growing up in Southern California, in my leagues that I played in were pretty good, and they also had size. So for me, it wasn't, you know, I didn't have the size, I didn't have the stature, so I had to play as if I had a chip on my shoulder. I was also, like I said before, you know, my mother was a single parent, so I didn't have a dad that was out there throwing to me. You know, we didn't have cages. Literally, my throwing partner was a wall, and, you know, I would makeshift a basketball hoop net, and I would hammer it to two trees so that my net was like this big, and I'd get off the tee with one baseball and I would hit it. It hit the net, it would bounce way back. I'd go get it. So like, I would just have to improvise because I didn't have the type of things that, you know, people have today, or even then, you know, someone to help them out and help them grow, you know, physically and, you know, fundamentally. So that for me was something that I felt like I had to overcome. And I, you know, there's two things you're going to do. One, you're either going to just mope about it and dwell that you don't have what everyone else has, or you're going to improvise and you're going to do whatever you got to do so that you can separate from, you know, that player. So that was one thing that I would do, is try to figure out what I could and couldn't do by myself. Obviously the physical portion that I can do, growing wise, until actually I think it was about my senior year going into my freshman year of college, for some reason I hit a growth spurt, you know, end up being 6'2", and nobody in my family 6'2". So it was one of those things that was super surprising, having to overcome just getting beat up by the bigger guys, in football, in basketball, in baseball. But I think when all that kind of came together, the physical aspect and knowing how I was playing and training myself as a small guy, you know, that rat that was running around, and then putting that mentality together with the physicality, you know, it helped my game tremendously at the college level, and then obviously professional level.
So what was your motivation to continue playing and then try to, you know, achieve your goals of playing at the highest level? Like, was it more, for me, for example, like I came from a similar background as you, where, you know, my parents didn't have a whole bunch of money, but I always wanted to make it to get drafted. I wanted to get drafted so I can get a big signing bonus and I could take care of them. You know, like that was a big goal of mine, was like, I'm going to make it in pro baseball so that I can help, you know, my family out. That was a big thing for me. What was your motivation?
There was a few different motivating factors. That obviously was probably number one. I wanted to be able to give back to my mom, to my family, my sister. And then I also, when I had kids, I wanted to be able to be in a situation to where they didn't have to go through that, you know? And it wasn't like I felt sorry for myself. It was just like, no, I'm going to make sure that my kids are taken care of and that they're going to have the ability to do the things that I wasn't able to do, not because I'm bitter about it, but because I know that they deserve it. And I know my mom did whatever she could do, given, you know, the cards that she was dealt, and I was grateful for that. The other portion of it was the fact that I was competitive, you know, just playing all these different sports. I also told myself, I'm an idiot sometimes. I think back some of the stuff I say, and I remember when I got drafted, and the scout was at the house with my mom, and we're kind of negotiating the numbers. And I remember just saying, I don't care. I'll make my money in the big leagues. And I think back and I'm like, dude, you could have got more. Like, what were you thinking? But my competitive nature was like, I don't care what anybody says, you know, I could have went back to a D1 and probably got drafted higher and played that whole game. But I was just like, I don't care. I'm ready to play. I'm gonna make my money in the big leagues. So I've always had that competitive nature. So part of it was obviously, you know, the foundation, giving back to my family, making sure that I can take care of my family that I would once have. And then also the competitive nature, knowing that every magazine that came out in San Diego, I was never in it. You know, there was the top 100 prospects. And I would read it and I would literally think to myself, I'm like, why am I not in this? Like, I know I'm good enough to be in the top 100 in my county. I got snubbed a lot, man. I got snubbed on, you know, first team, all league stuff. You know, I ended up getting like honorable mention or second team. And I just looked at this stuff and I'm like, you know, that's when politics really started to kind of creep into sports with me. I'm like, I did all this X, Y, and Z, and yet the accolades weren't there. I'll give you a funny story since we're on the topic. Please. One of my best buddies, his name's Trey Richards. I played baseball, basketball with him growing up, and his dad played in the big leagues with the Padres. His name's Gene Richards, and he was a 1-1, number one overall pick, like in the 70s, stole like 70 bags, and he kind of took me under his wing in high school. And I remember going to our senior banquet at high school, and every single person on the team got an award for whatever reason, sportsmanship, best defensive player, you know, it doesn't matter. Every single person got an award except for me. And I remember leaving but the funny part was the coach and the coaching staff, the way they talked about me is they basically said, like, he did everything. Whenever we needed someone to pitch, he pitched. Whenever we played second, like, I was like the go-to guy when everyone needed help. And for me, I just kind of kicked back, and in the inside, it ate me up, right? But when we left, and I had drove to the banquet with my buddy Trey and his dad, we left, and I remember his dad just going off. And he goes, what are they thinking? They say all this good stuff about you. They don't give you an award? These people are – he was more mad than I was because he was pissed because, you know, he took me under his shoulder or under his wings, and it just cracks me up because – to me, I had been snubbed so many different times that was the normality for me. You know what I mean? And it's what fueled, you know, for me to be competitive, for me to say, okay, you know what? Something funny I do, I don't know if you do it, but sometimes I go back and I look at my photos of teams that I played on, Little League, Pony, Colt, high school, travel, and I just look and I go, where did they end up? I always just go, oh, man, he played in the big leagues, or he was supposed to play in the big leagues. You know, like, you start looking back and you realize everyone's journey is different, you know, and we're so caught up as 10, 11, 12-year-olds, especially nowadays with guys, you know, are in 8th, 7th, 8th grade, and they're committing to D1 schools, you know, they're getting all these accolades and they haven't done nothing. You know what I mean? Like, imagine doing something and not getting anything, not getting any accolades or awards. Now everything's just kind of given to you. You know what I mean? But I go back and I look at those photos and as I'm older now, I realize everybody's journey is just completely different. And we're going to land, you know, I thought I probably could have played longer. Some people thought I could never make it. You know what I mean? So it's really just kind of what you do with that moment, with that opportunity. And the reality is, if you're enjoying the journey from front to back all the way through, I mean, for me, I have no regrets. Would I have loved to have been a, you know, Major League Hall of Famer? Absolutely. Who wouldn't? You know what I mean? Who'd love to be an all-star? But at the end of the day, I take a step back. And like you said, we want to get drafted. There's goals that we want to, you know, attain and achieve, and we did it. And there can't be any regrets. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a great point. That kind of leads me into my next question: is what did, when you were finished playing, did you have any like depression or any thoughts of like, man, you know, like, was there anything going on after you finished playing? Because for myself, when I finished playing, man, I definitely got depressed and I got fat you know, it was tough. It was tough for me. And I know it's tough for a lot of guys. We're in a Facebook group together with a lot of guys. You hear it all the time. Like, guys are, you know, depressed after they get done playing. How was that for you? What were you feeling after baseball?
So mine's a little bit different. Like, I actually had an opportunity to go back and play at the time. I just had ended my season and I was getting ready to go to Puerto Rico and play winter ball, where I was the third baseman on my team. I played there for like 3 years. And I honestly just wanted a break. I've been playing baseball, you know, since I was 5 up until the fact that I was 30, so 25 straight years, and mixing the other sports in between. But professionally, I got to the point where I would, you know, play winter ball all the way into spring training, and then I would play the whole season and then fall ball. So for some reason, I just kind of wanted to kick back a little bit. So I took a couple weeks off. And as I'm sitting there, you know, taking a couple of weeks off, I said, you know, I kind of like this, you know, just kind of like relax. And plus, I'm at the end of my career and I know it. Physically, I know what I can do, but opportunities are just shrinking because of the way baseball's moved politically and how they want to bring up younger guys. They'd rather give a young guy the minimum as opposed to a veteran guy, you know, what you could pay him. Would you pay somebody $15,000 a month, or would you pay someone $2,000 a month? It's a business, you know? And for me, I said, well, you know, I got to look at my next chapter of my life. I have to figure out what I want to do, where I want to be, continuing to play baseball, which is great, doesn't financially help my family. You know what I mean? Unless I'm in the big leagues or I'm in AAA, you know, making good money. So it became more of a financial decision for me. Puerto Rico kept calling, saying, hey, when are you coming? And I could have made good money there. And I said, maybe second half. So I skipped the whole first half. The soon as second half came in, they called me. Are you ready? I just said, nah. So I didn't have that retirement party. I didn't get released. It was really just me just kind of wanting to move on to the next chapter of my life, even though I didn't know what it was going to be. So once I actually made that decision and I realized I didn't want to play anymore, that's when depression kicked in, because now I have to turn sideways and go, what am I doing now? I had school money lined up from when I originally got drafted. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go back to school. I went to school online. I took 2 classes, got A's in them. And I said, this is not for me. There's no way I can do this. So honestly, and I'll be completely blunt with your viewers and everyone, I didn't even finish my college schooling that I had paid for. And I just let that money go away. Because for me, I felt like I just went from being a professional baseball player from 19 to 30. Like, that was my passion. I don't want to go to school because I have to go to school because I have money there. That doesn't make me happy. You know what I mean? So I decided to, and I always had done lessons before, even as a player. In the off season, I had, you know, clientele here and there, and I've always loved business. So when I was in college and high school, I always, you know, my favorite classes were economics, business, and, you know, things that could, you know, produce financial income. Plus it's got that competitive playing field to it. So just like anybody else that came out of baseball, they started doing lessons. And my goal was to figure out how to market differently. You know, how can I, you know, help these players, you know, become good defensive players, because everyone wanted to do hitting. So I wanted to do defense. I wanted to do fielding. Then I tapped into hitting, base stealing, and different things. And then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, but it turned into a pretty big business to where I had clientele. You know, for 2 years, I got talked into travel ball, didn't want to do it, hated travel ball, hated it. And finally, it got to the point where I got upset about travel ball that I said, okay, I'm going to take a team and I'm going to teach this team how to play baseball correctly. So I can't fix the whole travel ball scene, but at least I can take a team and I can actually develop them. You know what I mean? So that's how I got into travel ball, turned it into a business. But for about 6 months, I would say I was literally doing nothing. I was depressed and I was spinning my wheels on, you know, I was like, why didn't I have a plan? I could have went back and played. And then while I was playing, I could have had something set up. That way I could transition into it, you know, much easier, as opposed to just cutting the cord on baseball, sitting there on the stranded island with no lifeguard or no raft or nothing. Now I'm like, okay, what do I do? Which now I love helping guys that were in our position that played and are trying to figure out how to transition into life. You know, I mean, that's one of my bigger passions now, because I do different things in baseball, you know?
So when did the facility come into all of this? Because you have a beautiful facility in Temecula. One of my favorite, I love the way you got it set up. And I told you last time I saw you, like, if I ever open up a facility again, that I wanted to look very similar to the way you've got it set up. When did that come into play, and what are you doing with it now, you know, with life after baseball?
So originally I was in San Diego when I retired, when I just stopped playing. And I had clientele, so I would actually go to my college and my high school, and that's where I would run my lessons. So I do the fielding and hitting in the cages. I have lots of people that I'm close with down there, a huge network. And then it got to a point where my girlfriend at the time, we moved up to Temecula, an hour north, and I was cool with it because I had bought a house out here in Winchester in 2004, so I lived there 2004, 5, and 6. So I was cool just kind of getting away. And living up here for me is like being on vacation. You know what I mean? Like, when I'm in San Diego, I know everything about the place because I grew up there since I was 2. And I like to just feel like players, where we take that 4-game road trip and then that other 4-game and that 8-game. So when I'm up here, I really don't feel like I'm at home. It does feel like home, but it also feels like I'm still on vacation. So originally I had to get rid of a lot of my teams that I was personally coaching. Then I would go drive down to San Diego and I would coach those teams, and I still had clientele. Then it just got to the point where it was just too far. Not far, but it was just a grind, just to drive and do an hour lesson. So really, I kicked back for a year. I did no baseball for a year, other than when people called me and I'd help them. But I didn't seek clientele. I didn't seek team stuff. My 14-year-old team was still running in San Diego. And I said to myself, what do I really want to do with baseball? So after kicking back, I started building the facility real slow. I said, you know, I want a private one-on-one. I don't want it public. I don't need that. You know what I mean? I'd love to have 10, 15 hitters that I work with that I can help. I can help develop. I can go in there and I can film, you know, I can film different training videos and I can help people. Cause I, you know, at the time I had some demand across the country, but obviously I can't do nothing other than help dissect the swing or help them, you know, do an online lesson. So I basically got to the point where I was like, let me build this thing out right now. And then I'll just do it real slow. So that's what I really did, is I just kind of, you saw the place. I put the turf in, I put the nets. At first it was me for a couple months just going there hitting. You know, it was like my own little man cave. And then, you know, I opened it up to the public by, you know, appointment only. And I did my one-on-ones, and that's kind of how I started building up the clientele again up in Temecula. But previous to that, I did do some lessons at a place called Redline, which is like a franchise. They had two cages, but then they also had basketball court, football, and a lot of different training. And for me, it was just too much, you know, having to work the schedule to make sure I could get in the cage because people were doing football and they would move the cages across. And then one of the biggest things, I had so much stuff from my baseball career that my wife was like, get it out of the garage. So that I was able to take stuff out and then just kind of have my own. It's almost like a storage studio hitting facility. So it kind of quadruples into many things.
It's the sickest place, the coolest place. If you haven't seen it, you can check it out on my YouTube channel or Fernando's Instagram. It's super cool. It's like a little studio too. You got like vibe in there, which is awesome. Now tell me about that. Tell me about your Instagram. It's at Fernando Cortez Baseball. Actually, at Fernando.Cortez.Baseball. And what are you doing on your Instagram account? What are you showing up there? What can people expect when they follow you?
So really, I'm just kind of staying in obviously the baseball industry, and I'm trying to provide whatever content that I can. I grew the brand for maybe 2-3 years, or excuse me, so 2015. So almost 2-3 years I was growing it, and then the last 2 years has just been mostly, you know, I do some collabs, obviously, doing with you. And, you know, I don't just do baseball, so a lot of my time is in real estate too. So I do real estate investing and baseball. I kind of drew a line in the sand that it would be real estate investing and baseball. But the account, I'm just basically trying to give as much, you know, free content as I possibly can. Stay relevant in the game. I always preach that to people who are either coaches or players or whatever, is to use the social media platform so that they can continue to stay relevant, you know, especially when you're not playing anymore. It's super easy if we were playing right now to be relevant. But the fact that we're not playing, we have to use these platforms, you know, to stay relevant. And it also gives us a good channel to provide this information, you know, this free content and things that people can, you know, pick up and watch and then learn and apply. So really my page is mostly about networking and connecting. And then obviously still being able to provide content. I think a lot of our conversations started, you know, they stem from Instagram. You know what I mean? Like we were helping on certain things and projects, and Instagram really got it going. And then obviously when you're on the West Coast, you come out, we do our thing in person, but we're still able to utilize social media and, you know, grow and do whatever we got to do. So for me, I'm mostly on Instagram and Facebook, dabble a little bit on YouTube, but mostly Instagram. And that's where you're going to catch my content.
It's funny. You think that, you know, everyone assumes that if you played baseball, you know, every other baseball player, but we actually never met until I saw you on Instagram, and I was like, wow, this is an amazing page. He seems like a really cool dude. And I actually reached out to you. This was had to be a couple years ago. And that's how we started our relationship, and it's been awesome ever since. You are a dad of a football player. Give me some advice for those parents who have kids young kids who are playing baseball or softball or whatever it is, what can they do to ensure that their young players have success in the game moving forward?
I think the number one thing is you have to make sure that those kids are having fun doing what they're doing. You know, for me, I never wanted to force my daughter into playing softball. Prior to softball, she played soccer, she did dance, she did cheer, she did tumbling. And then one day she said, I want to play softball. I said, do you want to play softball? Because you want to play softball, not because, you know, daddy played baseball. And that was like the first conversation. I had to make sure that it was something that she wanted to do. My biggest advice would be to make sure that whatever sport they're playing, and like for me, I'm a firm believer in multiple sports and multiple talents and different things. So I can't force, you know, her to play softball because I play baseball. That's something to me, if you're forcing a child to play a sport that they really don't want to play and it's really your back end agenda, you're not going to get the love and happiness and passion out of that kid, because the reality is they're not there for themselves. So my biggest thing is, if you can recognize that they love the game, then continue to do whatever you can to put them in a position to continue to love it. You know what I mean? Once you lose the love of a sport or the passion for it and it becomes a job, it shouldn't be a job at 10, 11, 12, you know, like it should be, I can't wait. I used to, you know, I did this all the way up to, you know, professional baseball, but I would have my clothes folded. I'm talking sanitaries, you know, my stirrups, my cleats, my bat. I had my outfit ready on the floor the night before my Little League games, because I was ready to roll the next day. And that's what I wanted to do. You know what I mean? It wasn't like my mom came in and said, hey, get your stuff ready for tomorrow. She did that for school. I didn't like that. You know, I got it ready for the sport that I wanted to play and the passion that I had. So my biggest thing I always tell parents is, if it's something they love, don't do anything to mess it up. Don't do anything that's going to stop them from loving it. There's going to be times where you're going to have to get out there and help them, you know, do drills and other things. And you're going to have to force them to do that because they may fall into a lazy stage. That's cool. You can step in and you can still, you know, be that person that's pushing them from behind to help them. But don't make it a job. Don't make it a job until it is a job. Because at that point, you'll find some of the most successful people, the most elite players at the highest levels, when it becomes a job, they don't even love the game anymore. And you see guys just give up. And you play with guys that were probably very talented, end up quitting because it was too much of a job for them. You know? So imagine if somebody's 20, 22 years old and it's too much of a job for them. Imagine how much of a job it is for a 10, 11-year-old. You know what I mean? And mom and dad and everyone's yelling at them. It's like, I sit back in the stands. I think we've been in the softball league for almost 5 years. And there's people that now just come up to me and just now know that I actually play baseball. Because I don't say nothing. I just watch the game. My wife goes crazy on the umpires. And I just look at her and I'm like, okay. Because I know as a player and a coach, I know what people want to hear and what they don't want to hear. Or like, you know, if the parent will go up to the fence and tell the coach, you know, say something to the coach and then say something to the hitter. Like, hey, make sure you're doing this and doing this. And I'm like, that hitter's got to be alone. That is their moment. Leave them alone. Everyone's yelling at them. So my biggest thing is you just got to let them go. I know it sucks, parents, but the moment they were born, you cut the umbilical cord. You can't carry it on until they're 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. They're never going to grow. They're never, you know, they got to fail. They got to succeed. They got to understand the difference between the two. And when they do fail, they got to figure out what do they got to do to get over it and then move on, you know, from that adversity and how do you succeed? There's so many life lessons in it. But if you're holding on to that, you know, that kid, because it's your baby, and I get it, trust me, because I'm a parent too. So I'm speaking on multiple sides, you know, but you got to let them go. If they strike out and they cry, that's okay. You can still be there after the game and say, hey, you had some pretty good at bats. It's all good, you know, but let them enjoy that moment. Let them learn from it, you know? So my biggest thing is just leave them alone. That's my biggest advice. Leave the kids alone. If they love it, let them play. Keep going.
That's great advice. And that makes me think too, like when you give them the room to go through that and experience it, they're going to grow from that experience. But you have to, if you never let them have that experience because you're handling everything for them and helping them through their failure, it's just they're not going to grow as quickly as they normally could. In one of the videos we did, in fact, you talked about I believe I asked you about fear and how you handled fear when you were playing, because you always looked like you just had the confidence and the swagger. And you said something that like really struck me. And it was that you have two options when it comes to fear, the fight or flight. And you talked about how you always wanted to attack that fear. Can you talk about that again, and how possibly, you know, parents need to understand it, or kids can use it to feel better on the field, have more confidence on the field?
Yeah, I think it's anything. Like I said before, baseball obviously is teaching life. And I can give multiple different analogies, but think about when you're a kid, you're 8, 9 years old, and you went up to that roller coaster and you didn't want to get on it. So you have this fear for an hour while you're sitting in line behind all these people. You finally get to the front. You have two choices. You're either going to run away from it because you built up all this anxiety for an hour waiting in line, or you're going to hop on, strap in, and ride it. The funny thing is, when you hop on and you ride it, when you're done, what does that kid typically say? Let's do it again.
Yeah.
That was awesome. That's awesome. Let's do it again, right? And they would have never understood how awesome it was if they didn't actually go and attack it and just, you know, it's not always going to be comfortable. You know what I mean? Like hitting in front of 50,000 people is awesome, but it's not that comfortable. You know what I mean? My first at bat was in front of 55,000 people because it was on the July 4th weekend against the White Sox, who at the time were World Series champions, or they ended up winning that year. So like they had a huge crowd. It was fun, but it wasn't that comfortable. You know what I mean? But you got to get used to those things. I always say, in order to feel comfortable, you have to embrace being uncomfortable, right? So on a baseball aspect, that old saying where, you know, I don't want the baseball, but somehow the baseball ends up finding you. You have to want the baseball. You have to be the person who, you know, with the bottom, you know, you're the top of the order's coming up, but the bases are loaded, bottom of the ninth, two outs. Like, I want to be that guy. I want to hit. It's an anxiety driven situation, but I want to be in it. I want to live in that moment because there's so much greatness that comes out of it. And if I fail, I've been in that moment. So that way, the next time I'm in that moment again, I understand how to handle it. But if you're always shying away and you're always flight, you're not fighting the situation, you're running away from it, how are you ever going to attack that moment? That's why, you know, obviously there's gifted athletes like the Jordans and the Kobe's and the, you know, the LeBrons in basketball. And you look at, you know, Tom Brady in football. These guys want that moment, you know, and a lot of them are gifted physically, but mentally they know the majority is going to shy away from that situation. But them, they're putting themselves in a position mentally to know that that's the moment that they want to be in. And how many times have they failed? A ton. But you know what? How many times have they succeeded? And that success has only came from the fact that they understood how to move from the failure to success, you know? So the two things, like I said before, you're going to have, you're either going to go run after that moment and you're going to fight it, or you're going to run away from it. The more and more you run away from it, the more times it comes up to you, you're never going to be ready for it. So you might as well attack it now. Let me attack it now when I'm 20. That way, when I'm 30 and I, you know, adversity comes, I understand how to handle it at 30. Instead of for 10 years, I've been running from it. I don't know how to do this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people just get afraid of the moment and, you know, afraid of certain things, man. Like it can be anything. It could be somebody that's in a call center, you know, who they're afraid to talk to someone on the phone. Well, you take 300 calls and you're afraid. How about just take 300 calls and they might all suck, but 301, it might click and it might be like, you know what? This isn't that bad. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're able to do things, public speaking, just different stuff. So you're either going to run from it, you know what I'm saying, or you're going to attack it. I choose, and I think if you're attacking something, you have a better opportunity to move forward and succeed and grow from it. This is my personal opinion.
That's so true. For years, instinctively, I played with fear. And it wasn't until my senior year in college where something clicked and I said, I never want to feel that way again. Actually, we were doing PFPs and I got a ground ball and I went to throw it to first. It might've actually been in a game and I threw it first and I airmailed it into the stands. And I was like, oh, and it was embarrassing. And like you said, I felt all those eyeballs and that pressure of the game. I was just like so embarrassed. And I remember saying, I never want to feel that way again. I was always last. in PFPs. Like, I was at the end of the line, so I didn't get as many reps. And I was always hiding. I was always scared. I was running. I was flighting. And then at that moment, and I said, you know what? I never want to feel that way again. And from that moment on, I started attacking that. So from the next day, the first day, PFPs, first guy in line, I jump in line. Anything. When I grabbed that ball to throw it to first base, I would say, I'm throwing it with full conviction. I didn't care if I airmailed it anymore. But if I did, I was going to do it with full conviction and not be scared about it. If the catcher called fastball inside, I wasn't going to go, oh, I hope I don't hit this guy. No, instead, I'm going to throw it as hard as I could, fastball inside. If it's coming at you, better get out of the way. So from that decision, when I stopped playing from a flight aspect into let me go towards that uncomfortableness, that's when I had a lights out season. I was an All-American, and that was the year that I ended up getting drafted. And I truly believe it was from that one decision, that one feeling of changing from flight to fight and attacking fear. Let me ask you this. I see
one adjustment, right?
One adjustment, one thought. And it was just from then on making that thought of when I felt that way, when I felt that fear, go towards it versus die away from it. And that was the biggest thing, got me drafted and, you know, took my game to a whole nother level. I see you got a really cool Bruce Lee shirt on. You mentioned some other big names like Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, LeBron. Who were some of the people that you looked up to when you were growing up in sports, or maybe even just outside of sports, but like gave you motivation as you're coming up?
Well, when I say these names, you'll probably figure out where the swag's kind of coming from. But so Griffey was my first baseball guy. He drips in swag, right? He's got that sweet swing. I always loved Griffey, always will. I switched off of Griffey and I went to Chipper Jones just for a simple reason that nobody would trade me their Griffey Jr. cards anymore. So I was stuck with what I had. No one would give them up. So I had to find someone that nobody knew about, and I wanted to collect on that person. So it was Chipper. And it actually took, some couple cards from Chipper before he was in the big leagues, stacked up on him. And that dude, same thing. You see the way he walks to the plate, the way he plays. So I would mimic a little bit of that. And then one of my favorite two-sport athletes was Deion Sanders. And I mean, look at Deion Sanders, right? I'm not like that. But, you know, I'd have to make sure that I was the best on the football field and basketball. And, you know, that's how I played, was I had to have that confidence. And then, like I told you before, there were some days I didn't feel it, but I would fake it till I made it. So, you know, Chipper, Griffey, Deion, you know, my travel teams were FC Prime, and that came from Deion, Primetime. So FC Prime. So it was one of those things where he's one of my favorite guys growing up to this day. I actually just saw a commercial the other day. They were talking about, you know, COVID-19, and they did some NFL commercial. And on the back end of the commercial, Deion's in there. He's got this big old gray beard, and everyone's talking super serious. He gets on the last part of the commercial, and he goes, "We gonna be okay, baby. We gonna be okay." Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen it.
Hey, when you see it, and it's like, you're just like, that's the positivity. That's, he's so confident, you know what I mean? Like, that we're going to be okay. Even in these given times, he's like, we're going to be okay, baby. We're going to be okay. So there's just like certain guys that, you know, I fed off of, and I pretended, you know, I emulated certain things, kind of morphed and hybrid and kind of made myself. And that's just, I got friends that crack me up. I got a friend yesterday that texted me a Chad Johnson video. My boy Jerry Owens, he played in the big leagues with the White Sox, center fielder. And he sent me this video that Chad Johnson's just talking trash to his quarterback about all these players. And they're like, hey, he's like, how's 35? He goes, he's horrible. He's like, I'm me. He's horrible. Throw me the ball. And he sends me this message and he's like, I could totally see you doing that. I'm like, come on. I'm like, maybe a little bit. I said, I play humble. I said, but if somebody talks trash, I said, you better believe I'm going to, when I get them, I'm going to let the world know that I got them. You know what I mean? Like, that's how I grew up, man.
Well, think about it. Some of those people that we talked about, like Michael Jordan was known for talking smack out there on the field. Like, you know, Reggie Miller, there, you know, these guys, Deion, all these guys were very, you know, vocal about their game. I think, like you said, it's just stemming from ultra competitiveness. And I know some people say that having that much competitiveness or obsessiveness or passion about one thing is unhealthy, but I think it's totally healthy. I think that's what the most successful people in whatever they're doing are. They're totally zoned in on one thing. All of their energy are going towards that, and they're so passionate about it that, yeah, they're going to talk crap because that's what they're doing. That's what they love, and that's what they're feeling.
But think about this. So, like, I've seen Tom Brady, you know, I've heard that he gets super upset if he loses in chess or checkers, right? So all these guys, it doesn't matter what sport they're playing right now, that like they have that competitive nature, and doesn't matter what you're playing. It could be like a game of horse, or it could be a game of Monopoly. Like, they're going to try to beat you. And that's the difference between, you know, the super elite athletes and those players, is they won't accept losing. If they lose, they accept it as an opportunity to learn. But they're going to take that opportunity to learn so that they can figure out how to win the next time. So don't get it twisted when people say it's okay to fail. You know what I mean? That when I lose, it eats me up, but I'm smart enough to know that it's a learning opportunity. How can I take this moment to succeed the next time? So I'm okay with failing because I know it's going to produce success. You know what I'm saying? Like, so when I say, and a lot of people say, it's okay to fail, it's okay to fail, like, don't take that out of context. Don't just be okay with getting beat all the time. You know, be okay with learning from getting beat so that you can breed that into success. That's what we're talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's so funny that you say that, because Nick Shaw and I were talking about playing ping pong and how heated it would get playing ping pong, like with, especially in a locker room with a bunch of competitive guys. And you would think that it's the World Series game 7 in baseball in the locker room when you're playing ping pong. Guys are diving around, cheering, yelling, sweating and everything. And that just goes to show. Are you good at ping pong? I'm assuming.
Yeah, I like to say I'm pretty good. I played in multiple locker rooms, different teams. We played doubles. You know what I mean? Like, there was one guy that I played with. His dad was like on a national ping pong team in Venezuela. Oh, so he had taught him to play, and he was good. And like, we would just run, you know, tournaments, you know, we put it on the board. And so for a while I was playing consistently, I was pretty good. My buddies flew out from San Diego. They came out to Alabama, and we had a ping pong table in the garage. And I used to grow up playing ping pong with them at the rec center. You know, as soon as elementary school or middle school was out, we went to the rec center, played ping pong all day. So these guys were like, oh, I'm going to whoop you. I'm like, you have no idea what I've been doing for the last 4 years. And they got in there, and I was just running the table, just whop, whop. And like, I'm ambidextrous, right? Baseball. So when I'm playing ping pong, I can just move the paddle to one side and just pop. So I'm forehanding everything when I want, you know? And these guys are looking at me like, what have you been doing? I'm like, you don't know. The baseball locker room. We play ping pong. Been doing for 5 straight years, you know, tournament style. So, yeah. Now it'd probably take me a little bit to probably get going, but I think I could pick it up again.
I better be competitive right off the bat because.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, Fernando, thank you so much for. You cut out right there. Well, oh, there you go. Here. Perfect. I was going to say bye anyway. Thank you so much for coming by. You're actually doing, and I don't want to say you're doing, because I'm sure you're probably booked out already, but you had mentioned a few weeks ago that you were doing some live streaming lessons since we're all locked up like that. I'm sure you're probably booked up, but I'll have anyone who's interested, just the best place to find you is probably your Instagram, right?
Yeah, Instagram or Facebook. Most likely Instagram will be the one that I'll be on the most.
So at fernando.cortez.baseball, guys, go check them out. Thank you so much. That was awesome. It's always insightful. I always learn something from you every time we talk. So I appreciate you very much. I'm sure the people watching appreciate you very much. And keep doing what you're doing, man. Thank you again. And hopefully I can talk to you soon.
I know, man. I appreciate everything you're doing as well. Stay safe out there. You know, when this all gets, passes, we'll get back together. We'll shoot some cool videos. Appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. Love it always. Thanks, man. Stay safe.
All right, man. Peace.